Welcome to the Michael Slate Show. I'm your host, Michael Slate, and we got a packed show today. Towards the back end of the show, we'll be talking with Bobby Matos and John Santos, two musicians, extraordinary musicians, here to talk with us about the National National Academy of Recording Arts and Sciences announcing that they were cutting 31 categories from the Grammy Awards. We'll be talking about what exactly that means and what's behind it. Before that, we'll be talking with David Zeiger, the director of Sonosur and the co-director of a powerful new documentary feature, This Is Where We Take Our Stand. We're going to talk about the fight to get that new film, This Is Where We Take Our Stand, out into the world. But first up, I'm really pleased to be welcoming back PZ Myers. He's here, in a way, he's here for his monthly visit, but at the same time, he's here for a very special reason. Just recently, just earlier, a little bit earlier, there was a report issued by the International Program on the State of the Ocean, and that report stressed that it concluded that multiple ocean stresses threaten globally significant marine extinction, and they're basically saying that look, the oceans are in extremely bad shape, and we're headed towards what could be a mass extinction, and it's because of what humans have done to the oceans and to the atmosphere and to the whole world. And joining us to talk about that now is PZ Myers, biologist and associate professor at the University of Minnesota Morris, author of the science blog Pharyngula. And PZ, welcome to the show.
Hello.
Hi.
You picked a gloomy topic for us.
Well, it's gloomy, but it's really necessary. I tell you, I couldn't think of anybody I wanted to talk with about this more, you know. And as I was saying, people should know that this was an international panel of marine experts, and it brought together people from a lot of different disciplines, a lot of scientists, brought them together, and they came to a very specific, conclusion after examining what's going on with the oceans, and that was that it's a shockingly bad situation and that the implications of what's happening in the ocean are far worse than anyone on the planet ever expected. On first reading, PZ, is it as bad as it sounds?
Oh, it's worse. Yeah, the interesting thing I thought about it was that they take a very historical approach and they look at the history of the planet. And you ask, okay, what things were happening when there were other mass extinctions? And there have been several of them in the history of the world. Some of them dramatic. I mean, the Permian extinction, for instance, wiped out 96% of all species on the planet. So they asked, well, okay, what kinds of things were going on in the geology and the chemistry of the Earth at that time? And they identified exactly the same things that we see going on now. So it was warming, hypoxia, so we get reduced oxygen in the oceans, and increasing acidification. And right now, we're doing that to our oceans. We are doing exactly what has exterminated huge numbers of species on this planet in the past.
Well, tell me something. What is it that actually makes this report, though? What is it that they found out that is actually so distinctly different than what we've known before? I mean, people for a while now, for a couple of years, people have been talking about the lack of oxygen in the ocean, the effect of global warming, all this other stuff, the climate, the increase in climate temperature and all this. What is it that actually makes this report, what did they find it so distinctly different than what we've known before? Because these guys are actually almost in a state of shock.
Yeah. Well, what they discovered isn't something new. This is not like there's some earth-shaking, sudden, abrupt discovery that's been made that changes our perspective. All that happened is they got together a large group of people who were experts in their fields, and they said, sit down and talk about this and bring your perspectives together. What do each of you say about the oceans? What do each of you say is going on right now? And so basically it was a bunch of very smart people getting together and comparing notes and realizing that it added up horrifically in a way that was unexpected. So this, again, is not some dazzling new insight. This is just normal science, looking at what's happening and seeing a pattern and seeing the pattern jumping out at everyone when they sit down and do that business of asking each other what they see.
Well, now, you talked about the footprint that they did find now, the footprint that people actually knew to look for, because that was what existed in every previous mass extinction. This footprint can be found, and that is that, you know, a certain combination of acidification and I can't quite recall the other things, but there were three elements of this footprint.
Right. Now, so the three things are warming, loss of oxygen, dissolved oxygen in the oceans and the acidification. They all go hand in hand, and they're all symptoms of increasing carbon dioxide.
Mm-hmm. And the implications of that are?
Well, the implications are pretty dire, because one of the things they mention are some specific numbers, and they ask, okay, well, how much carbon does this? And they looked in the Permian, and they asked, okay, what kind of carbon output was causing this problem? They talked about numbers on the order of 1 to 2 gigatons a year being released during the Permian that led to the extinction of 96% of all species. And then they asked, okay, well, how much carbon are human beings dumping in the atmosphere right now? And it's 30 gigatons.
Whoa.
Whoa, yeah. So we are dumping it into the atmosphere at a rate unrecorded in history. It's something really exceptional that we're doing here. And we have no idea what the consequences will be. Except in the past, it's shown to be pretty bad.
Mm-hmm. Let me remind listeners that you're listening to The Michael Slate Show. I'm your host, Michael Slate, and I'm talking today with P.Z. Myers about a report that was issued on behalf of the International Program of the State of the Ocean, and it's about humans are killing the ocean, folks. That's what's happening, and what are the implications of that for humanity, for the planet, frankly, for humanity and for the planet. Now, P.Z., in addition to this footprint that we see is common in every previous mass extinction, there are other factors that apparently made this even worse. There's a synergistic effect of stressors. Can you explain that?
All of these things work together. That as we release more carbon dioxide into the atmosphere, that's dissolving the oceans. And you know, the oceans have a buffering capacity. You can dissolve a certain amount of carbon dioxide without radically shifting the pH. And what we're looking at is that the oceans are reaching saturation. They're reaching the point where they can't hold no more carbon dioxide without changing pH radically, rapid changes in pH. So we acidify the oceans, and what this leads to is things like the disappearance of calcium from the water column. And there's a lot of aquatic organisms that depend on calcium. Now, we depend on calcium in our diet. A lot of things swimming in the ocean depend on calcium in the diet. So all of a sudden, you're going to have die-offs of things like plankton, and you're going to lose shelly animals that live on the bottom. And it's all going to cascade and get worse and worse because this stuff is important for maintaining the health of the oceans, and we're throwing it off.
Well, one thing that they seem to be saying, too, is that in addition to this footprint, and I'll talk a little bit more about one particular aspect of this, the acidification, but before we get into that, I wanted to ask you this, because they talk about this, when I was talking about the synergy, they talk about there's something that exists now that hasn't existed in the past, and that is the fact that there's overfishing, that there's pollutants, these things that are very, very much done through human agency.
Right. So at the same time that they're being stressed by the effects on the environment, and this is like what we do in lots of circumstances where we cause habitat reduction, and that's squeezing the environment that the animals can live in. We're also directly attacking them. You know, things like these giant trawling nets that dredge the bottom of the oceans and scrape up indiscriminately everything that's on there for restaurant tables. Things like all these toxic chemicals that we dump into the atmosphere that are showing up in strange places, like the Arctic and Antarctic oceans, about as far from humans as you can get, yet those areas are beginning to show signs of pollutants. It's not looking good. You know, it's like we're poisoning everything and then killing everything off directly and then making it uninhabitable.
You know, one thing that also really, I read in this, at least in the summary of this, the executive summary of this report, one of the things that they were saying is that when you bring all these things together, one of the things that happens is that it's not only that the ocean reaches this saturation point around the pH and all this other stuff, but there's actually, in the past, there was an ability for the oceans to renew themselves, to restore themselves chemically. And that now what's happening is there's just, with being hit by everything all at once, there just doesn't seem to be any chance to do that.
Right.
And even if it was, it would take a long time.
Yes, this is that phenomenon of losing the buffering capacity of the ocean, is that they can no longer tolerate much garbage being dumped into them. They also mention, you know, that these sorts of things happen in the past, where the ocean has become acidified and deoxygenated and very warm. And yes, the ocean will recover, but they talk about timescales on the order of 100,000 years, which is a little while to wait. You know, that's not something for our grandkids or our great-grandkids or whatever. We're talking the long-term history of the human race is going to be impacted severely by this process.
Boy, I tell you, man. Well, one of the things that, you know, when you talk about acidification, I was stunned to see that it talked about, they were saying, and I think this is what you're starting to hit on, they were saying with acidification, this rate is higher than it's ever been in 55 million years. That's an intense thing to think about. And at that point, it was when up to 50% of some groups of deep sea animals were completely wiped out.
Right. And large numbers of land animals as well. You cannot damage the oceans without also affecting the terrestrial environment. So we're hurting everything.
Well, let's talk about that a minute, because one of the things that came up in relation to this was the severe state of emergency for the coral reefs.
Mm-hmm.
What is it?
Yeah, there have been a few circumstances where there have been major die-offs of reef organisms. You know, that in one event in the early 90s, something like 16% of all the reef organisms died. Just boom, 16% gone. That's a pretty big chunk.
Wow.
and just to be abruptly wiped out in a single year like that. Think what we could do if we put our minds to it.
Yeah, it's depressing, isn't it? On the other hand, that's something we'll get into towards the end, because it's also the one point of a possibility there in terms of doing something. But before we get into that, I mean, one thing that the report makes, and I was actually, there's two angles around this thing, even in relation to the coral reefs and the corals and the reefs. There's the one, the damage to the overall ecosystem. This is, ocean is a major earth system. It's a major earth system, you know, an earth ecosystem. It's essential. I mean, they have a thing in the report where they say, take a breath. And then they say, that breath would be impossible without the ocean, or with the ocean heading in the direction that it's going in, that breath might become impossible for anything to take. And I was thinking about this because they also talk about when the coral reefs go, and I read some statistics somewhere where they said, if you think about it, 30% of the coral reefs that had existed are dead. Another 30% are severely ill. They're hobbling down the hallway headed towards the morgue. And then the other 30% are okay. They're being, you know, they're okay seemingly, but the trajectory is not good for them. And the impact of that on one, the earth system that's being impacted. But then the other aspect is that, like, as you just mentioned, when this stuff happens in the ocean, it also impacts land animals, including humans, in a huge way. For instance, you know, a lot of economies, a lot of people's lives, a lot of people's safety, ability to function and eat actually depends on the healthy reefs in existence.
Right. Oh, yeah. And healthy fisheries are another important source of food for a large part of the world. And that's where a lot of our protein comes from, and it's being destroyed. What are we going to do to replace it? There's no talk of what we can do to repair this damage.
Now, they say that this is happening at an intense rate of speed, and that because of that, I mean, the whole thing, the whole synergy of all these factors, it's happening at a very intense rate of speed. And because of that, it's difficult to tell where we're at exactly in this process. And, you know, they said that, and I read one man's account who said, look, this may have already begun, you know, because in geological time, it seems to happen overnight. But in human time, we actually may be in the middle of this thing. What do you think of that?
Yeah, in the report, they talk about the time scales, and, you know, they're talking on the order of, 10,000 years for, you know, a mass extinction event, or in some cases, maybe a million or 2 years. That what it is this loss over this prolonged period of time. And that brings up something I think is really important to understand, and that is we have this kind of Hollywood sci-fi image of what an extinction means, and we think, boom, something explodes and everything dies all at once. We think of dinosaurs being smacked down by meteors and poof, they're gone overnight. That's not the way it works. But what happens is you change the environment, you produce unpleasant circumstances for them, for the organisms that live on the planet, and they slowly, slowly suffer and fade away. What we don't expect to have happen is that one day you'll wake up, everything will be fine, the next day all the humans will be dead. That's not what's going to happen. What could happen instead is there'll be declining standards of living, that there will be more and more health problems, that there'll be more and more famines, that what we would expect to have happen here is, you know, the old analogy of the boiled frog, that we're slowly going to get worse and worse, and we won't even notice until it's too late to change. So that's why human foresight is kind of important, is that what we should be doing is looking at the situation right now and noticing, hey, we're not catching many cod off the Great Banks anymore. what's going on here? What can we change to fix this situation for long-term sustainability? And people aren't doing that because they think, okay, we're doing fine right now, right?
Well, that we'll get into that in a minute. I want to remind listeners that we're talking with P.Z. Myers. He's a scientist, professor at the University of Minnesota Morris, and the author of the blog Pharyngula. You know, P.Z., and this is the first time I've had you on. I haven't been led to say or tempted to say Pharyngula because there's just nothing very happy about this one here. I'll tell you about this subject. And one of the things that you're saying in terms of this question of the timing of how we're getting there, this is actually it's very heavy because the authors of this study are saying things like, look, you know, we're talking, in some ways, we're talking within a generation or two. This could be it. Some people are calling for drastic action. Some scientists are calling for drastic action within 10 years or the trajectory won't be able to be reversed. What do you think of that?
Yeah, I believe it. I mean, you know, the fact that we're reaching the saturation point on the buffering capacity of the oceans suggests that there will be a point, a sudden point, where abruptly we will lose control, that suddenly the oceans will become uninhabitable to a large fraction of the life currently existing there. And at that point, you can't fix it. It's broken. Things are dead, and we can't bring them back from the dead. What you want to do is you want to start easing up the pressure now. We have to do it before we reach the breaking point. And yeah, it could be 10 years from now, it could be a century from now that we hit that breaking point. But if we keep blithely charging on, assuming that nothing's going wrong, we're going to hit that point and suddenly you can't change. You know, things like all these cars we've got pumping out carbon dioxide in the air, you can't suddenly say, okay, sorry everyone, you don't get to drive anymore. It's something you've got to phase out gradually. So the time to start is immediately. The time to start is, you know, 50 years ago.
But. Yeah. Well, here's a question, actually, and this gets to the point, because, you know, you can, you know, on one level, you can actually say to people, yeah, you got to stop driving immediately, but you have to give them a way to get around, you know, and this is something, or you have to build cities where they can have sustainable cities where people actually work where they, in close distance to where they live, all these other kinds of things that could be done hypothetically. And this brings us to the final question here. We're pushing the Earth to its limits, to its absolute limits, and this panel concluded that a new extinction event is inevitable if the current trajectory continues. But the real kick in the butt for me is that the panel also believes that we have the ability to reverse this. And they, you know, they talk about, look, human agency brought this thing, had played a big part in bringing this thing on, but there's also, we have the technology and we have the knowledge of what needs to be done. And, you know, and we could actually implement this and reverse it. But, you know, I think that there's, you know, frankly, it raises to me the question of, well, why aren't we? And it's not just because people don't want it, but there's actually, you know, there's this whole thing. When you look at these conferences and all, it seems to me there's a whole thing of the profit motive in the world and the way the systems operate that have certain things a priority and certain things aren't. But can you talk about, I don't know what you think about that, but you can comment on that if you want, but also can you talk about what are the things, when they say we have the know-how, what are the things that could be done to reverse this?
Right. Well, first of all, I think they're a little bit wrong. You know, it's not like we can reverse it because we're already in the middle of it. We've got lots of species that have gone extinct, are going extinct at a really rapid rate right now, and extinction is forever. We can't bring them back. So, in a lot of ways, you know, we're in the middle of the crash. We're charging ahead, and things are dying right and left. What we have to do now is slow down that process and maybe try to salvage as much as we can. But, you know, the kinds of things they talk about is the things that we have to do is, first of all, we have to have sensible policy on things like fishing, things like fossil fuel consumption. It's not something where you can tell people, well, I'll just do what's right. This is going to require actual regulation. It's going to require government intervention to make people do what is necessary for our continued survival. But the kinds of things you have to do is, yeah, we have to have sensible policies on fishing. You can't any longer dredge the bottoms of the ocean trying to catch a few fish and killing everything you find that you encounter on the way. We have to do things like control agricultural runoff. You know, I'm in Minnesota, and this is farm country in the Midwest. We've got this fabulous topsoil, and every year we watch huge quantities of it get washed down into the rivers and down into the Caribbean, where it makes a huge silt pile in the ocean there. We also see here, for instance, huge amounts of agricultural products thrown onto this land that then gets washed into the rivers. The rivers in this area are among the most polluted in the world. You cannot drink from the various rivers around here because they are full of pesticides and fertilizer. We've got to stop that.
Absolutely sick. Absolutely sick. PZ, we got to wrap it up right now, but thank you very much for joining us today.
Okay.
And talk to you.
We could go on for hours talking about what we're going to do, but yes.
And maybe we will at some point. That actually might make a very interesting show to come back and talk about what can we do to actually deal with this. So, PZ, we'll be in touch with you soon. The next month is coming up real quick, and you're going to be right back here real soon.
Looking forward to it.
All right, PZ. Take care. Bye now. All right, you're listening to the Michael Slate Show. That was PZ Myers, professor of biology at University of Minnesota Mars and the author of the most popular science blog in the world, Feringula. We've been talking today about the killing of the oceans and this new report that says, look, folks, we're a lot worse off than anyone ever even thought. And along those lines, I was thinking about something, talking with PZ and doing this, I was thinking about something that was very appropriate from Bob Avakian. And this is a quote on this. It says, this system and those who rule over it are not capable of carrying out economic development to meet the needs of the people now while balancing that with the needs of future generations and requirements of safeguarding the environment. They care nothing for the rich diversity of the earth and its species, for the treasures this contains, except when and where they can turn this into profit for themselves. These people are not fit to be the caretakers of the earth. And that's from Bob Avakian's new book, Basics. You can't change the world without knowing the basics. We're going to take a quick break and be right back. I heard them say Rome wasn't built in a day. By tomorrow night, I'll own everything. Can't see what's behind the scenes. Raise your martini glass to the land of dreams. That's a new song from the band Outer National. Long-time listeners to the show know the band. We've had them in here. They played live at one point a little while ago. And they have a new EP coming out. And that is the song New York Parasite. And you want to find out more about Outer National, you can go to www.outernational.net. All right, joining us now. Well, actually, joining us now is David Zeiger. And he's the director, well-known director of Sir No Sir and a dozen other things. And he's also one of the co-directors of a new film that you probably, almost assuredly, have not seen. And that film is This Is Where We Take Our Stand. And it's a film about the Winter Soldier hearings in 2008 that featured vets and active duty soldiers testifying about the savage nature of the occupation and invasion in Iraq. And Dave actually worked on that film for quite a while, and now he's fighting for it to get out into the world. And we're going to play you real quick right now a little bit of a trailer from that film. So take a listen to this. We'll be right back.
States.
I was 17 years old when I joined the United States Army National Guard.
I did three tours in Iraq.
I served in Afghanistan in 2004 for 6 months.
My job was to go out and basically annihilate the enemy.
Steve Martello, U.S. Army.
Jason Washburn, United States Marine Corps.
Selena Coppa, U.S. Army.
The death blossom was a term that we use regularly because once the shooting started, death would blossom.
My unit opened fire regularly on unarmed civilians while we conducted convoy operations.
The vehicle was driving very quickly towards a traffic control point. A young machine gunner made the split-second decision and put 200 rounds from his 50-caliber machine gun into that vehicle. That day, he killed a mother, a father, and two children. Colonel Rochelle turned in his chair and he said, and I quote, "If these f***ing Hajis learned to drive, this shit wouldn't happen."
The soldiers and Marines are not criminals. It's the policy that's criminal.
People just don't trust the media or the politicians or the generals with what's really going on over there. And this will be a chance for the ones with the boots on the ground to discuss what they've seen, what they've experienced, and what's really going on.
All right, welcome back. That's an excerpt from the trailer for This Is Where We Take Our Stand, and it's co-directed by Mike Mahouros, Bester Cram, and David Zeiger, who's also the director of Sir No Sir. Dave, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me. Good to be here.
Well, let's talk about this, because one of the things that we really have to say, as I told people, this is a film that the hearings happened in 2008. You were working on the film at the time, and yet this is a film that's a very good film, by the way. I watched it, and I really like it. It's a very concentrated, power-packed film about, you know, expressing the nature of what's going on in that invasion and occupation. But this is a film that people haven't seen at all.
Right. It's a film that has gone – the trajectory of the film somewhat mirrors what's gone on, I think, in this country since the time of the hearings. The hearings were in March of 2008, and what happened after that was Obama. It's just been a very interesting journey where, for example, we had a fairly large commitment from a foundation to be able to finish the film immediately after filming it. But in the months after that, that commitment was reversed, and the stated reason, and this became somewhat the mantra, was that this is no longer a priority. And with the Obama campaign and then the Obama administration, the idea that, well, particularly that the Iraq War is over, that this is the past, and that Afghanistan, I think it, on an even more disturbing level, the idea that Afghanistan is a good war, in the words of Obama, Iraq was a mistake, whatever that means, and Afghanistan is a good war, and of course we have to, you know, responsibly end it, and all of these things, this has had a huge impact, I think, it certainly has had an impact on film festivals and the way that programming has gone on in relation to these wars. It's had an impact on audiences, on people's willingness to see and be confronted by and engage with the reality of what the wars are. And I think we see this a lot with the WikiLeaks, the collateral murder video is very much on a par with My Lai, you know, in terms of what it represents. And actually, you know, the response, even though these things were, you know, with My Lai, it took over a year for the reality of what happened to actually get out into the public. These things, the reality is there. It's there to see. And the response is quite tepid. And I think that's had a big impact. I mean, you know, I have to say that where we've gotten a lot of support for the film is in the Independent Television Service, which is funded by Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and they fund independent documentaries for broadcast on PBS. The film has been finished now for a good while, for over 6 months, and we still don't have a broadcast on PBS. Now, of course, there are many possible reasons for that. PBS operates very slowly, but it's pretty clear to me that a film like this with the kind of veterans that are in the film and the political stand that those veterans are taking is something that PBS is going to have a very difficult time putting on the air.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with David Zeiger. Dave is the director of the award-winning and highly praised film Sir No Sir about GI resistance to the war in Vietnam. And he's now one of the co-directors of the film This Is Where We Take Our Stand. Now, this is a film about the Winter Soldier hearings in 2008, where vets and active duty soldiers testified about the savage barbarity involved in the U.S. invasions and occupations of Iraq and Afghanistan.
Well, let me ask you this. Because, you know, a couple weeks ago I interviewed Ethan McCord, who was actually the soldier in the Collateral Murder video who went and rescued the kids that were inside that van and then was, you know, basically harassed and you know, just tortured, you know, verbally and mentally all the rest of the time while he was in Iraq, came home, tried to drink himself to death, did all this stuff that was, you know, very just a horror. And he said, you know, he made a point that he said, look, there was one thing they couldn't make me do. I learned to live without a lot in Iraq. The one thing I couldn't live without, and I came to realize because of Iraq, was I couldn't live without my humanity. And at some point he decided also that he could no longer participate in taking the humanity away from the Iraqi people. And it seemed like a lot of the people in your film actually also had that same sort of revelation, you know, in the sense of, and it was very, very heavy. And then you think about, you're told, this is happening in the context of not just, you know, look, there's Obama's thing about, well, we're drawing down in Afghanistan, all this other stuff. But then there's also this stuff of, which has been very heavy coming before Memorial Day and afterwards, and it's going to increase. Love the vet, love right. the soldier. And that must have a huge impact on the political climate that you're taking this out in and the response that you're getting.
It's having a tremendous impact. In the world that I am in and that we're trying to get this film out in film festivals and television broadcasts, et cetera, there's a mantra of every film that has had any modicum of success that relates to Iraq or Afghanistan. And that is, for one thing, they're always centered around American soldiers. You know, but the other thing is that it's always, there always has to be this description of the film that it does not take a stand on the wars, or the soldiers themselves do not take a political stand on the wars. Because when they talk about love the vets, this is a big part of it. A big part of it is the concept, and this is from Vietnam as well, the concept that the soldiers are, you know, they're out there doing their best. They're fighting hard. They're doing what they're defending the country. And so even if you disagree with the wars, you have to support them. But when you have an increasing body of veterans and soldiers who themselves are taking a very strong political position against the wars, that doesn't fit the picture of, you know, of support the vets and support the soldiers. And this is it's very interesting because, you know, you could kind of on the surface, you say, hey, well, this is a film about vets. You know, this is the kind of thing that should be, you know, out there. And, you know, if that's your attitude, you know, support, you know, honor the vet, that's fine. But this is not this is not what they're talking about. What they're talking about is frankly stripping veterans and soldiers of any political legitimacy unless it's supporting the wars. And putting them on a pedestal in that context. I think that one of the president of IVAW towards the end of the film makes the point about, you know, you're always talking about, you know, support the vets, but you don't listen to them. And it's especially in this context, especially when there's a definite, you know, don't ask, don't tell is the general policy at this point, frankly, among large sections of the people in this country about these wars. And then I'm not talking about gay soldiers. I'm talking about the reality of what the wars are.
Exactly. Now, you mentioned to me the other day that one of the responses you get is when you're taking the film out to film festivals and to potential broadcast situations, you get a response that says, well, you know, your film isn't very hopeful.
Right, right.
What do you say to that?
We were told by one film programmer it's too depressing. And I've been quite stunned by that, but you know, because for one thing, there's hope is not an objective thing; it's defined by what you were hoping for. And you know, when people talk about that, they talk about, you know, finding some kind of a goodness out of this situation. And what's stunning about that is that the goodness and the hope in this film is exactly embodied in what you're talking about. Soldiers, these people who have been put in the position of of committing atrocities against the people of these countries. And rather than, and most of them having gone through periods of tremendous depression, alcoholism, et cetera, have come out of it and are coming out of it with a position of, I'm not going to allow this to continue. I'm not going to be part of this anymore. As one of the guys in the film says, I'm not the monster I used to be. To me, that's a pretty hopeful statement. But that's not the hope that people are looking for. They're looking for a hope that says, well, there was something good about what we did there, wasn't there? I mean, and I think actually I remember reading something Bob Avakian said towards the beginning of the Obama administration. That one of the things that's so disturbing about particularly Afghanistan is that a lot of people who should know better, they actually don't have a whole lot of problem with imperialism on a certain level, because as long as it's, you know, it has a nice face to it, or, you know, or it's successful. I mean, because that's what they talk about in these wars, you know, is whether the wars are successful or not. But what are you talking about when you talk about success? And I think that's something that these soldiers and veterans, they go after from their own experience.
And it is very powerful when they speak in their own voice, and basically they demand to be heard. Dave, I want to thank you for coming in. And real quick, tell us, if people want to see the film, what can they do?
that's a good question. They can write to their local PBS station, say, I understand this film is available on PBS. I really want to see it. I think that's a very we're going to have to fight for PBS to broadcast the film and for it to really be out there. You can also go to thisiswherewetakeourstand.com. There is a web series that's been up that has some of the things that are in the film, some things that aren't, but you get a good introduction.
All right, Dave, thank you very much. All right.
Thank you.
Thanks for having me. All right, we're going to take a quick musical break and be right back with Bobby Matos and John Santos to talk about the dastardly National Academy of Recording Arts and Science and their eliminating of 31 categories in the Grammy Awards. Welcome back, and that's Matamor Mambo from Bobby Matos and his new album, Beautiful as the Moon, a really great album, and I'm sure we'll find out from Bobby where people can get that towards the end of the segment. But Bobby is a percussionist, composer, arranger, and band leader, and he's joining with John Santos, a five-time Grammy-nominated percussionist and one of the foremost exponents of Afro-Latin music in the world today, to talk with us about the recent decision by the National Academy of Recording Arts and Sciences to eliminate 31 categories in the awards beginning in 2012, and the Grammy Awards beginning in 2012. Bobby, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
John, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Michael. What a pleasure to be back on your show.
Yeah, definitely, man. All right, well, let's start out. I'm going to go back and forth between you guys in order to make this flow fast and good. So, Bobby, real quick, let's talk about this. What exactly has the National Academy of Recording Arts and Sciences done?
They decided that their rhetoric was that the Grammys was getting too big of a collage. It was getting so huge that they were not able to get a grip on it. And so they decided to streamline it. This is what their rhetoric says. But we know that there were a few other things that caused this to happen. So what they did is they eliminated 32 different categories. And these categories just all happened to be categories that are favored by the independent companies, categories that the mainstream record companies, the monoliths, usually ignore. They're usually what we call genre music. So among them is Latin jazz, contemporary jazz, Cajun, Zydeco, blues, Hawaiian music, Native American music, and strangely enough, 70% of these categories that have been eliminated are all dominated by minorities. And we want to say, you know, well, maybe the intention wasn't racist, but the result certainly is. You know, it seems that we've only eliminated the ethnic categories, you know.
Well, you know what they say today, Bobby? Come on, man. It's a colorblind society, isn't it? There you go,
well,
man.
Well, I think it's not quite a colorblind society because I think it's motivated by the color green.
Very good point. Very good point. Now, you know, just to sharpen it up for people, what will this mean concretely?
What this means is that all the artists that are specializing in categories like Latin jazz and Cajun music and Hawaiian music, they do not have a category to compete in. Now, Naris has told us that we are welcome to compete in other categories, which is blatantly ridiculous because there is a huge difference between straight-ahead jazz and Latin jazz and Hawaiian music. You know, we're going to all be lumped, and we're going to be competing. Why should a Hawaiian album be competing with a Native American album, be competing with a Latin jazz album, or be competing with a straight-ahead jazz album? That's ridiculous. I mean, we fought for years to get Latin jazz a category of its own. We think Latin jazz is a very important part of the American musical scene. And we feel that rather than streamline the Academy, that it should be made even bigger. We feel that that it needs to be a large canvas to reflect the diversity that makes up American music and the diversity of the American population.
All right, we're going to bring John in, but before we do, John, I want people to hear a sample of your work. I know we had you on just a little while ago when you did Filosofia Caribeña, but I wanted people to hear a sample of your work from your album La Esperanza, and we're going to listen to Oshun Kole for about a minute and a half. So let's listen to that, and then we'll join you in talking about this. Is Oshun Kole, and it's from John Santos and the El Coro Folklorica Quindembo, and the album is La Esperanza. And John is joining us today, together with percussionist Bobby Matos, to talk about the recent decision of the National Academy of Recording Arts and Sciences to eliminate 31 musical categories in the Grammy Awards starting in 2012. John, welcome to the show.
Glad to be here again.
Yeah, we need you to talk into the phone so your voice doesn't go out, okay?
You know, my problem is I'm recovering from surgery, so my voice is a little bit weak right now. I'm sorry.
Oh, John, you made me feel bad now.
That's all right.
Okay. Well, I'm really grateful that you're here, and we'll try to make this as easy as possible for you. John, you were one of the people that, along with Eddie Palmieri, put in a lot of work fighting to establish Latin jazz as an award category in the Grammy, in the Academy. Did this elimination surprise you?
Well, it did, because, as you said, we fought hard for a long time back in the 90s to get it done. It took several years. It took a lot of lobbying, took a lot of effort, a lot of time. And we got Latin jazz and also a lot of other categories. Most of these categories that were eliminated were created back then in the 90s during that time. And it was a different administration in Naris. And at that time, it was something that we were very happy, very proud about. In a much smaller universe, of course, but in a way related to civil rights for musicians, where we made some gains. And now they're taking them away, and they're trying to say that they're no longer deserving of recognition after we had proved that they were.
Now, you're somebody whose music, whose work, generally, I mean, you've had Machete for a long time, and it was, you know, but you really have explored a lot of Afro-Latin music and really taken things from all over the world. You've incorporated a lot of different styles of work, different forms of music, and you've incorporated a lot of many, many musicians into your work that it's incredible. I mean, just people just looking at your album, any album can look at it and see, wow, you have a sampling of every kind of music and every musician you could possibly think of in your work, and you've really dedicated a lot to that. What impact will this have on your ability to carry out your work?
Well, you know, it's an interesting question that you ask, because we certainly existed before we were recognized by Maris, and we will continue to do what we do, whether or not Maris decides to do the right thing. But, you know, we have to kind of put it in perspective. You know, especially on a show like yours and your listenership, you guys deal with war and with some, you know, hunger and with some homelessness and issues that are a lot greater. But this is one of those battles that we feel we don't want to let them slide on, because it's indicative of a lot of things that are going on today in society, where people are being disenfranchised and rights are taken away after fighting hard to gain them. So as far as affecting what we do, you know, I've been very honored over my career to have 5 Grammy nominations, but all 3 categories in which I've been nominated have been eliminated now. So what it means really for me personally is just the elimination of recognition for our work. You know, for us, if and when we were to win a Grammy in these categories, it doesn't mean anything in terms of money. All it is recognition. It's kind of a lifetime achievement award in a way. And so they're now really telling, the message they're giving to the American public is that these categories that make up the roots of American music are not worthy of their attention, not worthy of recognizing. And it points to a lot of problems, you know, including the big one, which is the telecast that Maris is focused on, which is totally about commercial and pop music and devoid of any of this type of ethnic music or the kind of categories that got eliminated anyway. They're not supposed to be doing that. You know, the mission statement of Maris is to recognize artistic excellence, and it's a peer award. So it's not supposed to be the Justin Biebers and the people who sell the most records.
Well, let me ask you this, John, because you had, and I think it's important the direction you're going in, although I would actually add one thing. For me personally, what I think, and this is paraphrasing Bob Avakian, but, you know, there's a point he made about it's a very dangerous thing to not have a poetic spirit and be leading a revolutionary movement, you know. It's sort of, so I think actually when you were talking about the station, I think actually things like what you and Bobby do and what other musicians, and I have a lot of musicians come on this show and other artists come on, because I think it's an extremely important part of people's lives and of this struggle. And I think it's really, you know, it's very heavy when this kind of thing is happening, and it promotes this kind of idea. I was joking with Bobby about the colorblind society, but frankly, you had an exchange with one of the Maris officials, and I was stunned by the bold-faced arrogance and the barely hidden racism involved in this. Can you tell people what this exchange was?
Well, you know, I think that the gory details of it are probably not as important. It's just saying that there is arrogance among some of the people. Like in any organization, there's going to be a handful of people, and that's what's happening here. There's a handful of people who made this decision, and they don't want to admit the mistake, although many people in the organization have already admitted that it was a mistake, but yet they're not acting right away to fix it. They're telling us, well, it's a done deal for this year. All those categories are gone. Maybe next year, if you submit a proposal that we like, is basically what they've told us. We've met with them. We met with them last week, and they're just too slow. So what's happening, what's on the horizon, is a national boycott of the telecast. We hope that it doesn't have to go there, but that's what's on the horizon if they don't get it together.
We're talking with musicians John Santos and Bobby Matos about the decision by the National Academy of Recording Arts and Sciences to eliminate 31 musical categories from the Grammy Awards starting in 2012. All right, let's get back to Bobby for a minute. Bobby, how are you?
I'm good, Michael.
Okay. You mentioned earlier, you said, okay, you think it's, you know, there was different causes, what they said was the cause, all this stuff, and you said that you thought that there was something more involved. Can you tell us what you think is?
Well, yeah, I mean, we know there was something more involved. In the last couple of years, a couple of things have happened at the Grammys. First of all, the Grammys is supposed to be an awards that is a peer award. It's for artistic excellence, and like Frank Sinatra said at the very first telecast, it's about excellence. It's not about popularity. It's not a call-in or a text-in vote like American Idol, which is fine because American Idol says that that's what it is. It's exactly what it is, you know. The Grammys is supposed to be a peer group award. Last year, Best New Artist was won by a very talented young lady named Esperanza Spalding. Or Spalding, I'm not sure how to pronounce that. And she was a very talented jazz bassist and vocalist. And Justin Bieber, who thought he was a shoo-in for that award, went viral. He went on net and he asked all his little fans to boycott Esperanza Spalding and to write her nasty emails and stuff like that. And the people from his record label took a full-page ad in the New York Times, cost $40,000, and they said that Naris was out of touch with popular taste. And right after that, the executives in Naris took meetings with all of these people that were protesting. And right after that, the awards were restructured. The year before, Herbie Hancock won his Best New Artist against Kanye West. And he also went viral. All of these people that represent all of the major record companies, which is all nothing but pop music for the most part, all had a complaint. They don't want any indie companies winning Grammys or getting any kind of visibility because it takes away income from the major record companies.
All right, we're gonna have to wrap. We're gonna have to draw down on that one. And I want to ask one more question to John, and maybe get back to you, Bob, if we get a minute at the end. John, one more question. You mentioned that you're calling for a national boycott of the awards program, the awards telecast. There's a lot of musicians who've stepped up to oppose this. Can you give people a sense of who was involved in what really is a nationwide, and I would imagine in some cases from a worldwide movement around this?
Most certainly. We've had letters of support and letters of opposition from very diverse corners. Santana, Herbie Hancock, Edward James Olmos, Andy Garcia, Paul Simon, off the top of my head, also from musicians' unions from across the nation, and in particular in New York, in the San Francisco Bay Area, and in Los Angeles, the musicians' communities have really stood up in terms of the Latin jazz communities, but also we're starting to hear from the Cajun communities and these individual communities as well, the classical crossover community. People are stepping up to the plate, not only the musicians, but the fans, the people who support the music, and we hope that it's going to make some effect on their decision.
Carlos Santana, Bill Cosby, the Musicians Union,
yeah,
and many other organizations and many people in high places have all voiced their discontent.
That's really great. And actually, what can people here do? And tell us about GrammyWatch.org.
That's very important because the GrammyWatch.org is the website that we have organized that has information for people to find out what the reasoning for Naris is and what the opposition is from all camps and all corners. Also, more importantly, what people can do, which is to write letters, hard copies, as well as send letters electronically. The addresses, where to send them and who to address them to in the Naris brass is all listed there, and there's a petition to sign as well.
All right, John, thank you very much. Bobby, any last words in the last 10 seconds?
Yeah, I think it's very important to boycott the Grammy Street Party that's going to happen here in Los Angeles on July 30th. I don't know that they're going to have very many attendees anyway because they are charging $35 a head for it in the middle of the summertime when there are so many free events to go to. But the Grammys are trying to raise more funds. They've lost at least 7,000 members over the last year or so because so many people have just quit in disgust. Mm-hmm. And they're throwing this street party, which is a fundraiser, no doubt about it. And we're asking people to boycott the Grammy Street Party on July 30th.
All right, Bobby, thank you very much. Thanks to both of you for being on the show today, and we'll stay in touch.
Thanks for what you do, Mike.
Okay. Sure, thank you. Talk to you later.
Bye, Bob.
Bye, John. Take care.
All right, you're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate, and we've just been talking with Bobby Matos and John Santos, two Latin jazz percussionists and musicians who are in the forefront of this fight against the elimination of the 31 Grammy categories by the National Academy of Recording Arts and Sciences. Well, that brings us to the end of another show. And as we go out, I want to thank all of my guests today. I want to thank P.Z. Myers for coming on and talking with us about the devastating report on the state of the oceans from stateoftheocean.org, from the, you know, this whole report that was put together by scientists in Europe examining the state of the oceans and figuring out where we are. And as if you heard the section with PZ, you know we're in a pretty horrible place, all right? So check that out again and think about what you can do about that. I also want to thank David Zeiger, who is one of the co-directors of the film This Is Where We Take Our Stand. And that's a film of the Winter Soldier hearings in 2008 that featured active duty soldiers and vets testifying about the barbarity and the savage nature of the invasions and occupations of Iraq and Afghanistan. And I want to thank each and every one of you for tuning in like you do each week and hopefully tell your friends about it so we get more and more people listening. And then we can all come together and do what we're supposed to be doing with this show. What we started out to do was to really help people see the truth about what's going on in the world and on that basis be able to change the world. You know, one of the biggest weights that we carry around on our shoulders is the idea that there's no other way to live except the way we're living now, that there's nothing better than this system. Well, one of the things that this show is dedicated to bringing to you are examples of both how fundamentally rotten the system is and what's behind all the horrors that we have to live with and under here and all over the world, but also the possibility and the hope of change, possibility based on reality, on a scientific understanding of what's behind all this and how can we change it. You know, and one of the backbones of this show is something that Bob Avakian wrote about, and that is, he said, the truth will not set us free in and of itself, but we won't get free without the truth. Very important to remember, and that's one of the backbones of this show, and I hope it's one of the things that you take away from it each and every week. There is no reason that we're living like this. There's a far better way to be living, and the only thing it's going to take is us doing something about it. I want to thank my engineer for today, Teddy Robinson, my production assistant, Henry Carson, and my intern, Natalie Martinez, for joining us here today. And thank all of you for tuning in. If you want to write to me, you can at michaelslade@redfuture.com. Again, that's michaelslade@redfuture.com. And we're going out with a track that Bobby Matos and John Santos did together. It's called Mamba Mona Mix X. All right, so check this out. We'll be right back.